life better if they were smarter, per se. So we happen to have landed on this little weird niche where our brains are much more sophisticated and powerful than most every other creature. Some have more functionality because they have to be able to decode sonars and such, but that's a very specialized process that can't be generalized into consciousness.
And to extend, do you think that it was possible due to the extinctions that we had and the one that was caused by a meteor that hit the Earth that allows small animals to survive, the big animals, dinosaurs and others, and that was actually why we end up in, with consciousness bacteria?
Well, that a lot of the animals that we know and love evolved, probably it would be different if the meteorite hadn't dropped and the environment been favorable for small mammals. But there's nothing inherent in small mammals that would drive evolution to consciousness. And, you know, there's only really one species that's conscious. So, I mean, that is not, that if anything, that's just a statistical abnormality. You know, it's a one in a million kind of chance. So, probably if you reset everything with the dinosaurs and through a meteor, chances are we wouldn't be here today. There would be something else going on.
Okay, the next one is, for you, Dr. Roy, if you have both of the devices, the difference between nano-DNA and Rig Master and to exchange.
I think it's Rig Expert, but I have both of them. I kind of consider the nano VNA to be sort of a toy, although it is a two-port VNA, which the Rig Expert is not. The Rig Expert only has one port. You know, the nano VNA is a nice little thing. You could walk around, put it in your pocket. You could do all kinds of fun little things if you have decent vision. The Rig Expert is a much more big, bulky, but secure. You drop the nano VNA on the concrete, you got a 50-50 chance of it working. You knock the Rig Expert on the concrete, I would think that about 99% of the time you got a Rig Expert VNA that's fully functioning. So it's a little bit more user-friendly. The controls are a little bit easier to deal with, but it costs about, depending upon the bandwidth, it can cost as much as 5, 6, 7, 8 times the price of a nano VNA. They're both fine pieces of equipment for slightly different reasons.
From your practical perspective, would you find one port device less functional than two-port device material?
Well, I mean, ultimately it depends on what you want to use it for. If you want to use it to sweep your antenna and see what your SWR is, you don't need two ports. You know, if you want to do a little bit more esoteric circuit to design or repair, you may report two ports in order to get the measurements that you're looking for. 99% of hams, I think, can get by with a one-port VNA. You know, it's not a, a deal-breaker. But, you know, they throw it in, so what the hell?
Okay. The last one is, I don't know when I first read the title of it. I've read Beach UV550X3, but it's actually BTEC. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't wear my glasses. So, some Chinese stuff, not trying to be too much critical. BTEC UV50X3. It's a radio from Bifang, whatever. I cannot say those Chinese words properly. They say 4 years it took them to have a design of that radio. It's a three-band radio. And FCC approved, and of course, 220, 70 centimeters and 2 meters. And looks how it looks like. It has a button like everything else with the lights on it, so it's good in the dark. But, and it cost, okay, $429.89. Which actually for that money you can buy some good years from the old times that does the same. It of course requires 13.8 volts, 15 amps. So you gotta have to have an amplifier or a good cigarette lighter port for it. So it's gonna be 12 volts because the battery doesn't give you 12 volts on it. And the question is, did you hear about that, Dr. Roy, and what do you think about it, Victor?
I think vaguely, but I don't really need a mobile tri-bander, and we've talked before that Chinese stuff is inherently kind of iffy. I don't know what these things, you know, if it breaks, you throw it away, because I don't know who you send it to. You certainly don't send it back to China unless you want to spend a ridiculous amount of money. So, I don't know. There's other Chinese mobile UHF, VHF radios out there that have distributors in the United States that have been around for 10 years that are pretty much legit. So I would tend to go with them before these guys. And I don't know. I see a picture. It's a god ugly screen. It's a monochrome yellow. I assume the color can be changed. I don't know why anyone would take a picture of it when the background is yellow and the numbers look to be a kind of awful shade of brown. I don't know. Not particularly interested in this.
Okay. Actually, the last one is a question. Is listening to air traffic when flying on commercial airlines legal? That's the first question. The second question, is talking to the station from commercial airplanes when flying legal? So the first one, is listening to air traffic when flying on commercial airlines legal? So you actually listening to your pilot talking to the traffic, right? I found some comments on it. Listening to air traffic control radio communication from commercial airplanes is generally legal in countries like United States, Canada, and many other territories. However, it is illegal in certain countries, and there are restrictions of using radios on board of aircraft. The other comment is, some countries like UK, Germany, and New Zealand have communication laws written to protect radio users. Transmission that are meant for general reception to the public are allowed to be listened to. However, in those countries, ATC radio transmissions are only meant to be heard by other pilots or air traffic controllers. So that would be, if you can comment on it, or anybody could comment on it, and eventually if you could comment on it. You're flying on the second question. So you're flying on commercial airlines, and you have your radio, and then you hear all of the station on your 2 meters radio receiver, and it's so tempting to just push the button. Is it legal? Back to you.
Well, it's not legal because you don't have a license to operate those frequencies. You can listen, but you can't talk, at least in the United States. And, you know, back in the really good old days when security was not so prime an issue, You know, those were the days where the door to the captain's thing was left open, and it wasn't unusual to have some kid walk into the captain's area and be shown the controls and such and have a nice memory. Nowadays, security requires them to lock it and seal it and everything. So, you know, unfortunately, I can understand that other countries block it entirely, but you can listen, but you can't talk.
Okay, how about ham radio? You have your 2-meter walkie-talkie for 70 centimeters walkie-talkie, and all of a sudden you can listen to all of the traffic that is not available to you when you are at home, and you are on commercial airline. Can you push the button? Back to you.
I would guess that no. I would think the stewardess would suggest that if you continue doing that, she'd throw you out the airlock. I mean, you must remember the bad old days, the good old days, bad old days, where you had to turn off your cell phone because they were so worried that the internal electronics of your cell phone was going to interfere with some safety feature of the plane. So I'm sure that if you threw open your hand with an HT and started to gab to someone, the stewardesses would basically clobber you.
PhD with some info.
Okay, Jim?
I've kept an eye on this topic, and the way I understand it from the FCC regulations is that you can transmit from vessels like ships and planes with the permission of the captain. The captain can say yes, and the captain can say no. I think in most cases he's going to say no in the case of airline flights. But you cannot transmit it without the permission of the captain. That's my understanding.
Yeah, WB2IKT with a comment.
Yes, please.
Sure, okay. Transmitting is... from an aircraft is as described. You need the permission of the captain of the vessel, and you're not extremely unlikely to get it on a commercial flight. But even just to listen, a few years ago there was a company that basically made a crystal radio. These days I guess you'd call it an energy harvesting radio. But it was specifically designed to listen to air traffic control. And given the vagaries of crystal radios, I think we all recognize that the only thing it would let you hear is the actual aircraft that you're actually flying in. But those would be approved because they don't generate any additional harmonics. They don't interfere with anything. It just rectifies the signal and lets you hear. It doesn't generate a lot of dust. There's things like local oscillator radiation, local oscillator harmonics. You'd have trouble getting some kind of a receiver on that aircraft that would be active. The companies really try very hard not to let that happen. And as far as I know, none of that kind of stuff is approved. Right?
Oh, okay. I thought they kind of relaxed that a little bit after the, you know, because cell phones, they were really religious. I mean, to this day, we all have cell phones that have... that have airplane mode.
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount of trust in there that is probably not called for. But the thought process is that the airplane mode turns off any kind of, I'll call it local oscillator, you know, things that would emit a carrier from that phone. I'm not so sure it actually accompanies that. And, basically, the whole world of cell phones and electronic gadgets almost, you know, they talk about type acceptance in Part 15 of the FCC rules and regulations. You know, the FCC says, well, do it once and we'll accept it. But in reality, there's a huge amount of difference between those things. I don't have a lot of faith that people are religiously following Part 15, which is, you know, conductance, acceptance, and... radiation, especially the radiation part.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I airplane mode just really turns off the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth, the transmitter elements of the radio. You can't really stop the oscillators because, you know, it's a little computer. It needs an oscillator. It needs a timer.
Yeah. On the other hand, you know, the clock on the A to D converter or the D to A converter, which is sort of replacing your Super Edge converter, you know, I'm not even sure it has something called a local oscillator on it. They probably call it a timer.
Comment on the Wi-Fi.
Yes, Jim?
Recent flights I've been on have verified that airplane mode shuts off the cell network portions of the phone, but you can activate the Wi-Fi sections of the phone to interact with the plane's Wi-Fi services at certain portions of the flight. So that whole world is getting a little hazy on what's allowed and what's not allowed.
Oh, okay. I thought if you kind of switch on to airplane mode, the Wi-Fi shuts off. You could re-enable it, but I think part of the initial thing when you switch on to airplane mode is that and the Bluetooth go to sleep.
Primarily, the way I understand it, it's the cell network part of it that it shuts down.
Okay, one day when I have nothing better to do, I'll take my cell phone and turn it into airplane mode. What the hell turns off?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, people with hearing aids, some of them have the hearing aids connected to their cell phone, so that's through Bluetooth. That has to stay active.
Yeah, but I would tend to think that was a special case. I think they've relaxed these things in the present time. I don't know. I haven't been on a plane in a long time. But there was once upon a time where, you know, they really wanted you to turn off your phone entirely and put it away someplace because they were concerned that you would sneak it on. And the minute you turned it on, it would screw up all the navigational systems that at front of the plane.
Okay, Andrew Jean, 9/11, Pennsylvania plane. Hey, if you notice there is impossible to talk cellular on while you on the plane, the typical power of the cell towers and the direction of propagation of those antennas are about 1 mile, and talking about the power of the transmitter in your phone, does it look like it was BS? Didn't exist. Talking about all of those conversation that took place, because it is impossible to talk over the cell phone while you're in the air. Back to you.
Well, it depends on how things are set up. You know, I mean, there are some airplane companies that make money by giving you that service of hooking in to their connections and such. Someone wanted to mention in the chat room that you know, obviously pilots can do anything that they feel like doing almost. So there are planes that have ham radios in them. And there are pilots that when they get bored, they turn on their ham radio and have chats. Very nice coverage if you're in a plane. So, but that's a different thing entirely. That you know, captains can make rules for their plane.
Oh, so you think that those conversations that we saw on the videos from that time were because during the distress time, captain had enough of time to enable Wi-Fi so that people could have Wi-Fi. At that time, there was so many years ago, to be able to talk to their families or whatever. Back to you.
Again, it's not like I live on planes. I don't know when things kind of got rolled out. I remember there was a period of time where you couldn't show the stewardess a cell phone. It had to be turned completely off and stowed. These things ever so slightly changed over the years. I don't know when different things got reintroduced into the equation.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, very good, Wesley. So that's it for tonight, right?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you for participating, as always, and thanks everyone else out there for participating. I hope you had some measure of fun and learned something, and I hope you'll join us next week when we try and do this all over again. But it is 10:22, and certainly time for Paul WS2N to bring us the SpaceNet report. Brian, you want to make a quick comment?
The SpaceNet report. And, yeah. Let me just start off with one topic. I'm still following. There's a rocket being built by a private company out of Germany. They actually come out of Berlin, called ISAR, and they built a rocket called Spectrum. Spectrum is a 100-foot-tall rocket, around 6.5 feet in diameter. So it's a good-sized rocket. It's probably twice the size of, volume-wise, as the Electron rocket by Rocket Lab. And the thing that they are doing that's different is it's running on propane, and they have 9 engines, and also launching out of a brand-new launch facility in Norway. So, two things that are brand new. Anyway, they've been trying to launch for the last 2 weeks, and due to weather conditions, they keep delaying it a day to day. And anyway, this morning they got off the ground, and all 9 engines worked. I was hoping they were going to make it to orbit. They made it about 30 seconds, and things started to go wrong. Apparently the guidance navigation control system must have not been calibrated, and this thing started to go wild. It just a total failure. So the FTC, the flight termination, the FTS, the flight termination system was activated, and they blew it up when it got down near the water. Very happy with it, because their goal was just to really get off the launch pad. This has no European Space Agency money involved in it. Many countries in that. This is a private company, and if it was European Space Agency, they've been launching out of French Guiana near the equator in northern South America for decades. So they won't have a problem. But this is a private company, similar to the many companies that we're dealing with, and around the world. Spain has one they're working on. They call the Mira, and they plan on launching out of French Guiana. But this company gave it a shot, and they're going to try again. Once they get operational, they predict that they'll be able to launch around 30 rockets per year. So that would be going over the northern poles and launch. They cannot launch going east like most rocket companies can, because they would be going right over land. But there's a lot of missions that require going over the poles, and it would be they would get that. They could launch up to 2,200 pounds. So we'll see how they do in the future. This ICER company, hope they do good. That's what we need, more competition. We have plenty of different companies that are involved and worldwide, and we'll see. Any comments and any questions, check-ins, by the way, this is WS2N.
Hi, this is Brian, TAF2ZZ.
Good evening, Ryan, and very good. By the way, I looked up the that thruster thing you were talking about, those micro thrusters. I did look them up. Very interesting.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, there's a couple of companies working on that type of thing. And like I said, there is one trying to do it with water. Very, very small thrust. But the one that you talked about, I mean, the thruster has got to be, it looks like the size of a chip. Inside of a printed circuit board. But, you know, the idea is to have extremely small thrust, most likely for these CubeSat-type satellites. But very good. And if we ever see one get launched, we'll definitely talk about it, Brian.
Okay, sounds good. Did you hear about the Parker Space Probe making two passes around the sun now?
It's made quite a few passes around the sun over the years. What, that went up, I think, 2018. So, what it's been at, it's been out there, what, about 7 years now. So, that was launched on a Delta Heavy, which is like four Delta rockets. Three Delta rockets bolted together. And, only a couple of thousand-pound space probe, but they needed this big launch vehicle, to actually slow the speed of this vehicle relative to the distance from where we are, from where Earth is. When you go further in, you need a lot of power to get into a proper orbit. And now I think it's going like, last time I heard, it was over 500,000 miles per hour, relative to the sun. But, what was the report that you read, Ryan, that they got even closer this time? And each time they go by, they go closer to the sun.
I read an article where they said, I'm almost sure, that it said this is the second pass made around the sun at that altitude, I think.
That altitude, but they've done probably maybe 8 or 10 passes at least, orbits around the sun, and they keep using Venus as a gravity assist to adjust its orbit to get it in closer. Each time it passes. But last time I read about it, they went around. I think there were 4 miles from the sun's surface. And actually within the corona sphere, so that's pretty amazing. They had this carbon material on the front of it, protecting it from the heat. And it's about 4 inches thick. And by the way, the carbon material is the same material that they use on the front end of the shuttle and on the front edge of wings of the shuttle. So it really resists any kind of heat. So, and then on top of that, they also have an active cooling system for the solar arrays to try to keep them relatively cool. They need the sun rays to power this thing. And as it gets closer in, very close, they kind of back off with the arrays and pretty much run on battery power, and get further away than they just angle it differently where the sun's rays start picking it up. But even at that, though, no matter they are in the orbit, they actually have an active cooling system going on to cool these solar arrays. It's an interesting probe, and very good.
By the way, what is your call again? I think I wanted to send you something.
Yeah, WS2N, Whiskey Sierra 2 November. So, yeah. I picked that one years ago because it sounded good on CW, believe it or not. Yeah, you had a bunch of choices, and that's what I went with. Back to you, Brian.
Okay, back to you. I'm gonna go. I want to find a something. It's like a book. It's an e-book. I want to send it to you. I think you'd find it most interesting. Let me see if I can do that.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that. And appreciate it. Where are you located, by the way?
I'm located in Rockland County.
Okay. And I always dial up your call, repeat your call. I'd like to have that again.
Kilo Foxtrot 2, Zulu, Zulu.
Yeah, I just want to double check. I wrote that down a couple of times, including last week. I should make it more permanent. Copy of your call. Very good. What's the book in my about? Yeah, space program or astronomy? I'm just trying to get that back to you, Brian.
I'm looking for it now. I believe it was, let me just get the exact name of it. Give me one second.
Okay, very good. We'll wait. And eventually we'll move on to the story about polar flight. But we'll do that in a second. That's on April. Well, actually, between March 31st and April 1st, it'll be overnight. Falcon 9 will be launching a crew into polar orbit. I'll talk about that in a second. Over to you, Brian.
Okay, I'm looking. I'll be on the side for a moment.
Okay, very good. Thanks. Anyway, it's called FRAM 2. It's a crewed flight, four people, being launched by Falcon 9 from Launch Complex 39A, and it's going to go over the poles. I mean, you know, it's going to start heading south, it's going to go over the South Pole, North Pole, over and over again, for about 4 or 5 days. Now, it's unusual because a crew worldwide, Russians, China, Americans, have never done that before. They always go on usually an easterly track across the country, you know, from wherever they get launched from. They have gone as far as, I believe, a couple of the shuttle missions went 63 degrees inclination off the equator. That's about as far north as they've gotten, so pretty far. This one's supposed to be pretty direct, you know. I'm assuming 90 degrees, you know, within a couple of degrees of that. So they plan on doing that. We have plenty of satellites, low Earth, maybe hundreds of miles or even some of them are 500 miles, some of them are 200 miles above the surface of the Earth. You know, different kinds of satellites. A lot of them take pictures. They go to the same spot every every time they orbit, they can take the pictures of things that change from, you know, 90 minutes or so. Countless satellites do that, but for some reason they want to send this crew on that type of a mission as well. We were going to do it in the shuttle program many years ago. NASA planned on sending crews on a shuttle launching from California. As you all know, the 135 flights, shuttle flights, all left from Florida. They planned that in the 1980s to launch crews from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. But what happened was maybe 6 months or so before the first flight was scheduled to go. And by the way, NASA completely built the complete infrastructure for the shuttle flights out there, you know, access arms, elevators to get up and all, places for the crew to put all the spacesuits on and get ready, and everything was ready probably about 6 months or so to go. And then we had Challenger, and Challenger changed everything. At the first 73 seconds, everything was fine, and then Challenger was gone, killing seven astronauts. After that, they said, well, we're going to scrap this idea for now and just launch people out of Florida. And because of that, nothing ever flew out of there. They spent billions on setting up everything to fly out of California, but it never happened. But most of those flights would have been pretty much polar flights. Flights that all fly out of Vandenberg Air Force Base are pretty much polar flights. Again, they have a similar problem to launching out of Norway, where this proton rocket tried to make it to orbit. They cannot go east. The same thing for Vandenberg Air Force Base. They cannot go east. They'll be going over, you know, over Arizona. You know, and if something goes wrong, they don't want to either land in the desert or, worse than that, land in some condominium out there. So they all launch, you know, they go in the polar direction, which a lot of military flights, spy satellites and things like that are done with weather satellites as well. Flown out of Vandenberg. Yeah, go ahead, Brian. What are you?
I'm looking at your QRZ profile, but there's no email address.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I should put all that. What I have it. Anyway, it's spacenetreport@gmail.com. spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Brian.
Okay, give me a minute.
Copy that. Very good. And let's see. Anyway, this polar flight that SpaceX is launching. They have this guy, Chang Wang. He's one of these people that are into the cryptocurrency, some kind of an investor. So I'm assuming he's like probably one of these multimillionaires or maybe a billionaire. And he's the main guy for this flight. He's officially not the commander, so he must be, I'm thinking maybe he's the money guy. I don't know, the way SpaceX works nowadays. And there's another fellow from Norway. He's going to be the vehicle commander. And then there's a woman, Erica Phillips. She comes out of Australia. she'll be the pilot, and another fellow out of Germany, another specialist. One out of Germany is also a woman. So two guys and two ladies going to be on this polo flight for 4 or 5 days, and they say they're going to run a whole bunch of different experiments. The only one I really sort of had a chance to read about was they're going to try to grow fungus on the air. I don't know how they can do that within 5 days. I guess that's possible, but they're going to give it a shot. And the idea is the fungus is, they said it's going to turn into, mushrooms or something. And theoretically, you'd be able to eat these mushrooms in the future on long flights, long space flights. They're going to grow mushrooms, and people will eat them, and that's all you got to eat. I'm not going. First of all, I don't like mushrooms, and if I did, I've got to be able to eat them for 6 months on the way to Mars. But interesting, anyway, they've got a whole bunch of experiments, they said. But we'll see how they do. They plan on launching, I guess tomorrow night, around 9:30 or so. And the name of the flight, they're calling it FRAM-2, F-R-A-M-2. And the reason they use the name FRAM, that was the name of a ship that used to go, in the old days with Amistad down to Antarctica, and the same ship was also used to go north to the North Pole area of the Earth. So they're saying, that's really FRAM-1, and because this is a polar mission going over the South Pole and the North Pole, they're calling this mission FRAM-2. So, we'll see how they do. They're using the same spacecraft that SpaceX used not too long ago. Again, not a NASA flight. It was another one with a crew that went into orbit, and they wanted to test an EVA, extra vehicular activity, a spacewalk by a private citizen. And they did that. And to do that, they needed to change the hatch in the spacecraft to be able to be open from the top, get out to the spacewalk. And now that's been changed back. That's now been changed back where they put what do they call it, like a cupola, a 1 meter diameter window on the top of the spacecraft. So that's now reinstalled. So the crew will get some kind of a view. Using that as a viewing port. And we'll see. I don't understand the push for this particular flight. First of all, they're not NASA flights. They are not going to an international space station. They don't have that for luxury. You need to be able to dock to something, 2, 3, 4 days. This one is 5 days, 4 to 5 days, in a tight quarters. Seems unnecessary to me. I would, you have the space station, you make a deal with NASA. They've done it before. Axiom is a company that leads private space station that's actually going to be attached to the International Space Station over the next couple of years. Maybe about 4 different modules. And eventually, when it's built up and up, and they plan on deorbiting this International Space Station. I just got an email. That's probably from Brian. Thank you, Brian. We'll look at that shortly. We'll see how this all goes. Anyway, let me just get back to Brian for a second. WS2M.
Thanks, Paul. I appreciate it. Your knowledge is usual. I think what I sent concerns the mathematics determining the proper orbit around Dolly Parton's midpoint when she was younger.
Oh, okay. I'm trying to bring it up and talk at the same time. Anyway, we're going to give it a shot. And here we go. Email. And Brian. And click on the link. Okay. Looking for this here. Okay, we're clicking on that. Space propulsion and space and spaceship design. Okay, looks good. We'll read it later. Thank you, Brian.
More than welcome. I think my joke went over you.
Sorry, I missed what you said that time.
I think my joke went over you.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, no problem. Aeronautical engineering. Okay. Thank you for that. Okay, I wonder if anybody has any comments or, for the net. This is WS2N.
KUSOB, I had a general related question in relation to the Artemis program.
Okay, a little low. Did you say in relation to the Artemis program? Did I hear that right?
Yes, that's correct. In relation to the Artemis program.
Oh, sure. Go ahead. Again, you're a little low, so I missed your name. Again, name here is Paul, WS2N.
SLV, Kilo Echo 2, Foxtrot Lima Bravo. And my question is essentially, with the two recent failures of the Starship launches, as you know, with a couple of other failures from commercial space companies trying to do moon landings recently, do you think that Artemis is still feasible in its timeline and just, the technology and the mission itself? Or do you think we're going to see another, drawn-out push like we have in the past with previous attempts to return to the moon?
Yeah, I read everything I can read about it. And recently, NASA is really pushing the Artemis 2 program. There was some question maybe about a couple of months ago. With the Elon Musk Starship, you could use that instead of, what NASA's been working on for the last 10 years or more. The Artemis program, which, of course, involves the SLS, the space launch, which will launch Orion spacecraft all the way to the moon with crew on board for Artemis 2, which... Again, they're saying this September, they apparently worked out the problems with the heat shield. The Artemis 1 that circled the moon was a very successful 25-day mission, but the heat shield, they weren't happy with that. Apparently, they've been working on that since then, because that's what, two Novembers ago when they did that. Two Decembers ago. So they worked on that, and that looked like a go from what I've been reading, which is great. I think more important now, since the Starship, the last one, got as far as over to take, was the Bermuda, over the Bahamas, and then blew up over Caicos Islands, and the same one, the same exact thing happened on the last flight and the flight before that. And they had to initiate flight termination system, FTS system, which is a bunch of bombs inside of a rocket, which will either explode on their own, or you know, you could actually detonate them from ground control. If these things go out of control, they're all required to have that system. And a couple of failures there. They think that, you know, from another article I read, that they could be having a major problem with repairing that, trying to figure out what's wrong. Apparently last time they thought they had it, and they didn't. The whole thing blew up almost identical to what happened the first time. So I think they got a ways to go before that gets corrected. We'll see. You know, the plan is, this plan is to eventually get the Orion spacecraft into orbit around on Artemis 3, not the one in September. That's got a planned crew of four going. And then you have three Americans and one fellow from Canada. They'll be going orbiting the moon on a 10-day flight, come back to Earth in the Pacific Ocean, check everything out, make sure the Orion spacecraft is good enough for human consumption. So Artemis 3 will again launch a crew of four, orbit the moon, and the plan is to meet up with a Starship. Now, a Starship, they can't get this thing to orbit, never mind to orbit the moon, but they need to meet up with a Starship orbiting the moon. They need to send two people into the Starship and leave the other two in Orion. Send the Starship down to the moon, land there for who knows how many days, do what they got to do, then get back into the Starship, lift off again, and dock with the Orion spacecraft. From there, go all the way back to Earth with all four people. That part is in jeopardy, but you know, NASA always believes in this. So years ago, when they were deciding on having a human transportation system, you know, essentially a shuttle system to go back and forth from lunar orbit to the moon, they initially gave the contract out to just SpaceX. And after a while, that was a bad idea, because I figured they would have at least two different companies. There were at least three companies bidding to do that, and they only picked one. But sure enough, a couple of months passed, maybe 4 or 5 months, I think, passed, and they realized that this is a bad idea. We have to give another contract out. We have to have redundancy. If one doesn't work, we have to have the other one. They gave it out to Blue Origin, and they are in the presence right now of building a lander called Blue Moon. Blue Moon is a lander that looks nothing like the Starship. It looks like a real oversized limb, you know, the original landers that we had. I mean, but this thing's tall. I mean, I forgot the numbers, but Blue Moon is probably, it's got to be, let's see,
I would say maybe 40 feet tall. It's a big thing. And the capability of bringing a crew down to the surface and again taking off and going back up to lunar orbit. Now, the reason they need to get the lunar orbit so important is because the other part of this whole system, like Artemis 3, which I'm sure you're hoping works out, no matter which one they use, if they use the Starship as a human landing system, or if they use Blue Moon by Blue Origin for the human landing system, whichever one they use, that would be Artemis 3. Artemis 4 is a step even bigger. By the time they get to 4, which is roughly every year they plan on launching another crew to the moon. What they plan on doing is having the Gateway space station in orbit around the moon. That's going to consist of 3 or 4 modules that people could live in for maybe a month or two at a time if they wanted to. You could have a crew up there. For instance, on Artemis 4, what you would do is dock with the Gateway space station with Orion after launching on the SLS system. You know, you'd be able to dock there. You could have 4 people living in this space station as they orbit the moon, and when they choose, they decide everything's go, they'll be able to open up another hatch and get into one of 2 spaceships, either the Starship or the Blue Moon lander. And from there, that, you know, whichever one they choose will be able to go down to the lunar surface, their experiments, and then come back up again.
That time complete.
Gateway space station. From there, all 4 would get back in and go back home. So that's the ultimate plan. And right now, they're still sticking with it. You know, the way things are going, I don't know if that's going to be the final solution. But right now, that still is the plan. Back to you. I forgot your name. It's was it KE2FLB, WS1.
Yeah, thanks. You pretty much answered all of my questions. So thank you for taking my question. This is KE2FLB.
Yeah, okay, thank you for the question. And, what was the name? I missed the name.
I apologize. The name is Race. That is R-A-I-D.
Okay, R-A-I-C. Very good. Great. Nice question. Glad you're out there. Anyway, I'm looking at the time. We're running out of time. I did want to mention one other rocket that has now been certified, talking about redundancy for flight for the government, for our government. They need certification for France. And Vulcan has now gotten that certification. They've had 2 successful launches so far with the new Vulcan rocket. These are heavy lift vehicles built by Boeing and Lockheed Martin. And I'm glad to see that they have the certification to launch spy satellites and all of that, weather satellites. They got the okay for government launches for the Defense Department and all. The Vulcan rocket is going to, the idea is to eventually phase out the Atlas V rocket, which has probably had 108 launches, I guess, over the years. And that they're phasing that out for this new multi-use vehicle. They could launch really heavy launcher satellites or even smaller ones. But Vulcan is going to be really very good for our country. And we'll see. All right, with that, I'm going to turn it back to Roy.
thank everybody that checked in, everybody that stood by and listened, and we'll be back for next week. And Ryan, thank you. I'll read your email once I get off. Over to you, Roy, for tonight. And by the way, I always mention that the club.